Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works. Or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the award-winning writer, actor and bon vivant, Matt Bainton. Hi, Matt.
Some of those are true. Hello.
Matt, you're best known, obviously, as a star of things like Horrible Histories and The Wrong Mans. Should we talk about Light Lunch?
Yeah, my television debut.
Your TV debut on Light Lunch.
I brought this up just now. Didn't really expect you to bring it up.
It's what we're mainly going to talk about.
Record button has been pressed.
We're not usually in the habit of ambushing the guests, but it just feels like such a nice story.
I guess I a student, probably. I certainly had enough time on my hands to be watching Light Lunch pretty much every day with my friends, and we thought it would be fun to go and sit in the studio audience. We even baked a cake for the band.
Did you? It was a band. What sort of band?
Don't you remember the band? And they had a different name every week. And it was always
like
a breakfast-based name.
Oh.
So that week it was Roxy Muesli. And we baked them a cake. My friend Chris Harrop baked a cake which said on top of it, "Shake your booty, it's Roxy Muesli." And I think this endeared us enough to the sort of floor manager that she picked me out to introduce the show. They used to have someone from the audience would introduce the show and then say roll credits at the end. And I did, so I read the auto cue, and I think it was Murray Walker was the guest. So I read a bit about Murray Walker. I really hope no one can find
it. It'll be on YouTube. This will get
someone always finds it.
Dig it up. But that
I
experience.
Hadn't grown into my features yet.
Oh, right. Will we not recognise you?
No, you will. That's
do you look
the awful
like a pepper
thing.
Army? Is it that sort of a look?
Yeah, the big nose and the big chin were there, but the rest of the face was not large enough to accommodate them suitably.
The superstructure.
I'm very pleased to be sharing a room with a fellow big nose, big chin brother.
It's nice. It's like looking into a mirror.
It's scary. But that experience of going up and seeing things recorded is really, especially if you want to get into comedy and things, the first time you go up and go and visit a studio, and you feel really lucky if you had that chance as a kid, if you lived sort of within the environs of somewhere where they were recording comedy. We went to Fry and Laurie, I think. I went to see Fist of Fun, I think, being recorded and things.
Oh, wow.
And it was really fun.
The pilot of Room 101, we went to that, didn't we?
I never thought at that. I have always been obsessed with comedy, but it was relatively late that the penny dropped that that was what I wanted to do. Right. I thought it was just something I loved. But I also loved music. I mean, basically, I wanted to be what Jason was. In fact, I used to come and see Ben and Jason.
Did you?
Yeah.
And wow. Didn't teach you
And I had your
lesson,
album, yeah. Candidate. God, yeah. I wanted to be a musician. I played in bands until relatively recently. But that was always the first love, like many comic people, I think. Just there's wanted big, to be a failed musician.
There's a great big comedy music crossover, isn't there? It's yeah. huge.
People who love both and people who do both. I mean, you can yeah. see Kevin Eldon's a terrific singer and a really good guitarist. And
yeah.
It's very common. And I think there is something, comedy more than any other kind of form, I guess, of writing or storytelling depends upon an understanding of rhythm.
Yeah. 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 And also you learn things. I was noticing this, especially because we do a lot of pastiche, and you learn to do a pastiche. And you learn to write in the same way as you learn to play the guitar and learn to write songs by listening to other people's ones.
Yes.
Copying what... There's a chord progression to a news story. There's a chord progression to a yes. review of a lawnmower that you can learn. You can copy it. And you know when it's right and when the notes are flat. And, yeah. and you find that rhythm and you learn... Not only how to pastiche things by sort of this is what a Tomorrow's World report, this is what a news report looks like, but you also learn by looking at, say, Python sketches and working out how the rhythms of them work. And I think one of the things that's really interesting when you find your own voice as a comic writer is you realise sometimes when you're doing someone else's sketch.
Yes.
When you're just doing a really good cover version of Monty Python or yeah. Fry and Laurie. And sometimes there's a joy in saying we're just using all their rhythms because yeah. it's a classic blues number. But you've learned how yeah. to do it. And then occasionally you go, well, I'll put an unusual chord in here. I'll switch this round.
Exactly. And I think I love as well when you reach that point where you can kind of knowingly not do the trad thing yeah. or yeah. the kind of the cover version. There was a moment on a show I did called Quacks that James Wood wrote where he'd written this brilliant monologue for Rory Kinnear, which was a sort of absurd Victorian adventure story yeah. that turns out not to have been true. And there was a line in it about natives playing, I can't remember what the detail was, but it had the word flute in there. And Rory sort of pitched to James, can flute be the last word? Because I think that's the funniest word to end on. And James went, I know it is, and that's why I don't want it to be at the end. And I kind of love that. That sort of, I think that's really nice when you're at that level of detail where you're sort of choosing which laughs you want and which you don't, and sort of which feel a little bit easier or
it's cadences. It's exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's what's the last chord? Is it? Does it resolve to the root note, or does it end on something sort of bluesier or more unusual or jazzier?
Yeah,
there is a lot in it, and I think it's to do with how you learn how to do it as well. That you're always made of a mess of your influences, and then also where you've chosen to transcend those influences.
Yeah,
that's brilliant. Well, that's comedy done.
How did we get there?
I can't remember.
Great, good. So from Light Lunch, it's totally coincidental that Light Lunch came up in the little preamble beforehand, because where I was going to start with this is I was going to say, because this genuinely occurred to me when I was having a look at your thing. You know, sometimes you have a really sensational meal that leaves you so full and delighted, and then a bit of your brain says, I can't have that meal again. What I think you've brought in here is a sensational meal that you can have again and again and again, because this has got this. It's got everything, and it left me absolutely full and delighted watching it for the nth time. What have you brought in, Matt?
I've brought in the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Boy, is it good.
Isn't
Boy,
it?
Boy, is it good.
Yeah.
It's better when you come back to it, though. It does get better. Because legendarily, this is a very badly reviewed, very...
Huge
flop, very criticised, and it's definitely a film that the second time you watch, you go, oh, God, yes, it is brilliant.
It is that brilliant thing, which is that it doesn't insist upon its own excellence. It really plays like a breezy first draft of something very throwaway and silly and fun and goofy. And it's deceptive, because when you go back, and I watched it again, I hadn't watched it for years, actually. It just looms large as an influence for me. It is. Every single moment of it is just perfectly pitched and perfectly placed.
It suffered, if I remember rightly, it suffered in my mind when I first saw it, because it comes out straight after Fargo. And the Coen brothers have made Fargo, and the Coen brothers are sort of fairly freewheeling and ramshackle and tonally. They just enjoy tone, and Fargo is undeniably a tight, well-written demonstration of their craft and skill. And they bring out this thing straight afterwards, which looks like a loose, shambolic first draft. They haven't even thought it through.
But they wrote this before Fargo.
Yeah.
It's the loose ends in it. Like we were just saying about sort of choosing not to do the thing, the sort of textbook thing.
Yeah.
For example, they set up Quintera as the antagonist beautifully with this slow motion sequence. John Turturro, yeah, absolutely
sensational costume.
They do this whole build up about who he is and his backstory as a pederast and going door to door, and then you see him again later, and they've tried to move the date of the semis.
What's this day of rest shit? What's this bullshit? I don't fucking care. It don't matter to Jesus.
And any other film, it's about the when you finally see the semi-final, yeah, and are they going to beat him? Doesn't happen.
No. They do
it ends before that happens.
It's amazing. They do a rule of two with his scenes. He appears once, twice to confirm his threat, and then he's not there.
And then it just doesn't...
What's exciting about this is it's got that mastery of it, because it doesn't care, and it sort of... They've earned the right. They've written a lot of tight films, a lot of tight scripts, and they've got this sort of Chandler-esque plot running in the background.
Mm.
And it's as if to say, well, we could do that if we wanted to. We could write a pop hit. But we fancy doing this something different instead. Yeah. And it's got... What I find really amazing about it and really enjoyable about it is a bravura demonstration of all their crafts and skills. Character building, dialogue, set pieces, plot, narrative, direction, all these stuff. And they're using them to create a world in which there's something really... Something that a really good writer will do, which is to give each character their own independent arc and reality, that a character will want something and exist outside the film and have their own wants and needs. And this is a film that's got a vast cast of interesting character actors, occupying interesting characters, all of whom have got their own little film. And the film itself doesn't actually show all those worlds together. So these people just drift past. And the odd thing about it, when you watch it a few times, you go, oh, that's like life.
Yeah.
Weirdly, this thing is supposed to be heightened and not realistic, but oddly, that experience of being a bit part player in other people's stories is how we all exist. And we're all drifting past each other.
That's why it sort of elevates itself, I think, ultimately. And I think the key to that is the death of Donnie.
Yes.
Is that in a kind of quote-unquote normal film, even a comedy, that's such a strange move to make. You get this really funny scene where they confront the nihilists and Walter finally kind of goes full Vietnam, as he's promised to. And then he turns around and said, man down. Has he been shot? No, he's had a heart attack. And it fades to black and he's dead.
Yeah.
And it hurts because that's not... They haven't paved the way for that with a plot. They haven't... They foreshadow it ever so slightly with a shot of him rolling and... one skittle is left standing.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's the only thing, and that's only moments before that tiny little sort of foreshadowing of it. What's lovely is you don't... I think we're so used to how story is crafted.
Yes.
Mm.
That if a character is going to die, we know it.
Yeah.
We really know it in advance because the whole thing has been woven towards that moment. And it's genuinely shocking. And as you say, that feels very much like life. That whatever that big story or that big adventure is, someone can drop down dead, and that's what matters.
I think there's something really exciting in this film as a comedy, and defending the role and the importance of comedy, is that if you were a critic who wanted to look at the whole of the Coen's work, or even just cinema, you would say that a film like Fargo is realistic. There are realistic consequences for realistic characters you can believe in. And The Big Lebowski is a film that is heightened and non-realistic and cartoonish and larger than life. But when you look at how the mechanics of Hollywood plotting work, they're not realistic at all because things have consequences and setups. It's all fake. The weird thing about this film is it's got this heightenedness to it that it seems to be unreal. But the way that things happen for no reason, or that the big, carefully knotted plot turns out to be bullshit, to not matter, is actually how life really is. Your life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And the dude's got other plans. Everyone is heading in a different direction that is nothing to do with the ostensible Raymond Chandler story.
Yeah, I mean, the film is like is serially inconsequential, isn't it? Constantly, yes. Even down to the micro level, where the conversations that the three of them are having just go round and round in circles. That rug really tied the room together, you know, that kind of thing. And shut the fuck up, Donnie, and that kind of thing. No one seems to get anywhere at
no
any
one's
point,
listening
which
to
is
anybody.
Great.
I mean, the relationship between the three best friends in the middle of it, Donnie and Walter and the dude, they don't listen to each other.
I love
it's
again to come back to music. I think the first thing that really kind of blew me away about the film was the dialogue in those scenes of the three of them together. That the from a musical point of view, I mean, it's kind of we talk about contrast and rhythm in writing, and it's we say it so much it seems cliched and obvious, but it's so you have the dude who is a languid and calm kind of melody. You have Walter, who is like a brass band, sort of
blaring,
blaring
away.
And then Donnie is this little piccolo kind of and he just asks questions. It's all he does. And they've sat him the other side. He's not even physically with them. He's the other. He's got his back turned, and he just turns around and says, "I'm the walrus." I'm the walrus.
It's like Lennon said, you look for the person who will benefit, and
I am the walrus.
You know, you know what I'm trying to say.
I am the walrus.
That fucking bitch.
Oh, yeah.
I am the walrus.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie. V.I. Lenin. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov.
You know, or just asks questions, and Donnie and Walter turns around and says, shut the fuck up. But it's so... That's such brilliant, perfect dialogue writing.
It's great, isn't it? Because you sort of wonder, why are these three with each other? And the answer is, because they bowl together.
Yes.
They're bowling mates.
That's the other thing. I think you can imagine the executive, particularly about the dude and Walter.
Yeah.
To have a hippie and...
A neocon, basically.
Someone obsessed with NAM and obsessed with combat in a positive way is an insane... pairing. Why would they be friends? And the executive note would be, we need to just go, you know, a few lines just to explain to the audience why they're friends. No, we meet them in a bowling alley. That's enough.
Yeah.
They care about bowling, so they're friends.
But they care for different reasons, don't they? You know, I think the dude just wants to roll. Walter, I think, wants to win.
Yeah.
You know, he has that. There's that great scene with, this isn't NAM, this is bowling. There are rules
where he pulls out a gun
on someone,
Smokey,
doesn't he?
Yeah. Am I the only one who cares about the rules?
there's something. I read a piece that someone had written about this, about saying that there's something. Why is it compelling? Whenever you've got a little team of people and you're setting them up, and one of the reasons this is a lovely film is that you enjoy the company of the characters. They're all lovely and they're all horrible in their own different ways, but they're all compelling. You want to spend time with them and watching them. And the core group, the three at the beginning, there's such a lovely friendship, which there shouldn't be, but it's got a sitcom feel to it, as in they're a mismatched bunch of people who've been thrown together by a sit, and the sit is the bowling alley. I love the fact that John Goodman was in the Flintstones movie, because there's a real Barney and Fred bowling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It does feel a bit like a cartoon or a sitcom. Mm. They're a gang of people. I read this article. It said that when you look at what Walter and the dude represent, they're the two sides of America in the breakup after the 60s. One's the idealistic sort of pacifist version, and one's the hawk. And the great thing about this film, and why it's lovely to watch, is they really get on. And it's almost like this plea for, oh, God, I'd like to live in the America this is set in.
Right.
Where those two forces could be friends.
Right.
Like a liberal and a neocon. And it's like, oh, it is a fantasy world where, hey, they've got something in common. They all want to bowl together. And it's just, there's something really hopeful. There's loads of hope in that friendship, because they shouldn't be friends.
Yeah. And weirdly, again, sort of when you look at the text on the page, and Walter just, all he ever really says to Donnie is, shut the fuck up, you miserable piece of shit.
Yeah.
That ought to play as really horrible. You really ought to feel like, this guy's awful, they shouldn't be friends, I feel so sorry for that guy, he keeps shouting. But it doesn't really play like that. It plays in that way that we accept that, like sibling relationships, that you basically just shit on each other the whole time, but you deeply love each other.
Yes, well, I read an interview with Steve Buscemi in Rolling Stone, and he said when he first got sent the script, he didn't want to do it, because he just thought they just treat Donnie awfully. One completely ignores him, to the extent that there are theories going around that Donnie is a figment of the dude's imagination, which is bullshit. And Walter is just horrible to him and shuts him down the whole time. And he said, it was only when I got to the bit at the end in the parking lot where Walter then defends Donny and stands in front of him just before he's keeled over by a heart attack. And he said, oh, they like him. I didn't realise they liked him. And that's when he said, OK, I'll do the film, yeah. Because he thought it was a really cruel bit of writing to begin with.
There's a very telling thing in... The Coens are amazing. Their casting is always brilliant. The great thing about them is they've got a rep company of people they
use. Yeah, and they use... Yeah.
And it's almost like the American version of, I don't know, Carry On or something. They're a big bunch of people who've got characters they can bring with them. And the thing about the three guys in the middle of this is... Everyone likes those three actors. They're very likable. Is it Pauline Kael said that Jeff Bridges is the most unselfconscious screen actor who ever lived? You don't feel any of them are working or trying hard. You just like spending time with them. And you get the feeling that the actors themselves are probably nice guys and they like each other. And something shines through almost beyond the script. They've cast it so well that there's no way that John Goodman doesn't really like Steve Buscemi. And it's something to do with just clever casting, that it shines through the lines.
Yeah.
There's more going on than the words.
It's amazing how the rhythms of speech, the sort of interrupted, the kind of cul-de-sacs that they take themselves down, most of them don't ever finish a sentence without restarting it.
No,
and those
true.
Actors make it feel like that's them taking fully written sentences and rendering them in a more kind of real, thinking on your feet kind of way. But in fact, they're all written that way.
And it's got that in common with something like With Man and I, that it's sort of slightly freewheeling and these people. But what though both those films have got in common is they're very written and very heightened. And yet they feel, I think we go back to it, it feels real. And there's something authentic in the very crafted weight of the words. It still feels, it's not attempting to be real. It's not Ken Loach, it's not realism. And yet there's something authentic and real about how it plays.
Yeah, yeah. And occasionally you can hear the writing, like, so Maud, she's just one who, all her language is kind of slightly twisted and fruity, you know. She talks about the porno as the beaver picture, and she mentions 100,000 stones or clams, whatever you call them, and she means dollars. And I was sitting there going, I'm sure they've just made that up. No one's ever called a dollar a stone.
Well, it'll be Chandler, because they were trying to write the big slip. They said they wanted it to be like... The reason it's set in LA is they wanted that Chandler thing. Yeah. And it's got... I thought as well, they based it a little bit on sort of the shambling private eye pictures. It's got a whiff of Columbo about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why I picked it as well, is that I realised... The Wrong Man's is just basically, it's probably the biggest influence on it.
You can tell. It's the wrong person with the wrong job.
Exactly, and with a buddy who's up for the... who wants to tag along even though he wasn't invited.
Yeah.
Because Walter drives the plot. He's not the...
Yes, exactly, because if it was just the dude...
I mean, he constantly drives it off the road, but he was at least driving.
That's the thing, is that I came across The Big Lebowski when I was... 18 or 19, I was on my year out after A-levels, and I worked in a call centre for a bank and was just utterly miserable and drank and did drugs, basically, to bury my deep, deep sort of funk.
Disappointment in yourself.
I hadn't got into... I'd applied to a course at university. I hadn't got in and was thinking of, you know, okay, I'll take a year, I'll work, I'll save some money and I'll apply for drama school and, you know, fingers crossed, maybe it'll work out. And I hated my job so much that I spent every penny I earned at the pub or with my drug dealer. This is quite a big confession.
I think we all had those years. It's fine.
And I hitherto had not been really like into film.
Yeah.
You know, I'd grown up with Spielberg and Back to the Future and all these great
sort of
movies.
Exactly.
But was not sort of a student of film in any way. And this guy worked in the call centre for 1 week, who was like this quite cool guy who was kind of culture, and we would talk about music, and he mentioned, oh, you'd love the Coen brothers. I hadn't heard of them. And he said, The Big Lebowski, you should watch it. I think because he knew I was smoking weed every lunchtime. And I bought it on DVD, and it was the first DVD I ever owned. It was... When did DVDs come out?
Around... It's going to
it
be
was
late,
around that
late 90s.
It was an early DVD, right?
95, 96.
No, it's guess. But I think my first one I would have bought when I was... I remember buying on DVD, I bought Spinal Tap and Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. And frankly, I don't know why I bought any other DVDs, because that's all you need.
Right. Well, I would add Lebowski to that, but... So it was the first DVD I... We didn't have a DVD player, but we had a computer with a DVD drive.
So that's quite a good computer by those standards.
Well, yeah,
then,
thank you. I was doing all right. And so, and because it was, because I'd paid for it, I watched it loads. I watched it.
Are you listening to this, Spotify?
That's the thing,
yeah,
I own.
Exactly. So I watched it a lot. I absorbed it completely.
Yeah.
And then, kind of years later, my girlfriend is a film historian, and I met her when I was, it was around that time, in fact. And so I've been utterly kind of educated in film noir and all of the influences that the Coen brothers had on this thing, The Big Sleep and The Long Goodbye.
But it unlocks
and
all that stuff. It's a good way of introducing yourself to those tropes, I suppose.
I think so. And so that's the thing. By the time we came, The Wrong Man's came from me thinking that a sitcom noir, a sitcom that was based on the kind of noir story structure, if you could argue there is such a thing, but those tropes, was the idea. And I wasn't thinking about the Coen brothers by then. I was thinking about those things that were the influences that they had. But re-watching the Lebowski now, I'm going, oh my God, we just, so much of this is in The Wrong Man.
But it's
because it was just so
but the structure
in there
of,
for me,
of going further and further into a sort of labyrinthine plot, and that being explored by meeting a series of characters, each of whom has a secret or an element of the secret, which is the Chandra-esque structure.
Yeah.
Is, I loved that about The Wrong Man, that every week the answer was with a different person from a different level of the conspiracy or the criminal.
And every week the protagonist is thinking, this is the last thing I do and then I'm out.
Yeah.
Once I get this done, I go back to my life, it's fine. And the dude just wants his rug back.
Yeah.
You know, and Sam just wants to go back in The Wrong Man. Sam just wants to go back to work because he doesn't want his boss, who he loves, to hate him. He wants to get back with her. So he wants to get back to work and do his job and impress her and be back with her. And with us, we're sort of always trying to find ways of making him appear to be doing the worst possible thing as far as she's concerned.
Yeah.
So, for example, we did a thing where they end up with a hostage in the office. And the hostage is sort of chained to a radiator because you don't want them to, because he'd beat me up. So, and he says, I need the toilet. And you go, well, I'm not going to unchain him because then he might be lying and he might hurt me. So what would you do? So we kind of cut to Sam with a plastic bag that's clearly got a poo in it, walking out of the office, and he bumps into Lizzie, the very person he wants to take him seriously, and then she smells it and he has to say it's his own farts because he had a roast dinner.
But you've got the structurally... what you're doing there is turning a noir into farce. And the situation there is that you've got an unwilling protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
You've got... this is how Lebowski works, is you take... It is the worst person to give this plot to.
And
it opens up with a wrong delivery. It opens up with pure Hitchcock, with they've got the wrong guy. It's how North by Northwest starts.
Mm-hmm.
You start it by mistaken identity. You're supposed to deliver a thriller to number 13, and you knock on the door of 13A, and in 13A is the worst person who has no interest in being in this thriller.
Yeah.
And then you see what happens after that. And that person, the really hard thing to do with the script after that is to try and keep that person motoring within that thriller when they don't want to be there.
The funny thing about the dude is that when you're answering that question, who's the worst person to visit this plot on, is the kind of question that as a writer you're then answering. With Sam, in The Wrong Man's, we answer, well, a sort of middle management coward.
Yeah. Not a hero.
Yes. And with Lebowski, I think the dude is a really interesting one because on the one hand, he is someone who just wants to go bowling. And dealing with all that is a pain in the arse. But again, what's really nice is they don't adhere to that in a really strict and obvious way, because actually he begins to quite enjoy it. And in a way, someone who's unemployed has got time to go on that adventure.
Yeah.
And when he starts later on to kind of be going, you know, this is a complicated case, a lot of ins, a lot of outs.
When he meets
you
the
get
other
the feeling it's like, yeah, that he's quite enjoying playing that role.
And they're talking to each other as if they're equals. And
yes.
I was watching that scene, really enjoying it, going, he's not a detective. Why is he using brilliant. These words?
And he's so angry to be...
when did he become a detective? Yeah,
the Knutsons? That's great as well, because that's a moment in the plot where it's already confusing and it's just the right time to go... Here's a completely extraneous and utterly confusing detail.
But there's a really nice Joel Cohen's quote about it. It said that what they want to do is something with a hopelessly complex plot that's ultimately unimportant. Mm. And there's something joyous in when you're trying to follow a really complicated plot and your brain's going, oh God, do you know what? I just want to enjoy this film because the characters are so good. It's a bravura bit of writing to go, do you know what? I don't think the plot's important. I think you're losing track of this. And I'm empathetic to you as an audience member not following this. And I'm going to drop some clues that the lead guy doesn't think this is very important. So wouldn't it be funny if the joke was that he didn't think it was important? Then at the end, that he's right and it wasn't important, because it's a hunting of the snark, it's a boojum. The thing they find at the end isn't really there, and there was no crime.
Well, the whole thing, the whole
there was
thing.
No kidnapping, there was no money,
there was no one was mutilated, no the victim wasn't mutilated.
No, that
the
was Amy Mann's toe, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Amy Mann just turning up as a mutilated woman.
With Flea.
It's full of pointless musicians' cameos.
The whole thing is summed up in that bit where he's at Treehorn's place up in the hills, and Treehorn takes a phone call and makes a note on a phone pad and says, I've just got to go out of the room for a minute.
And the
dude goes, right, there's a clue there, and goes over there and scratches the pencil on the pad, and it's a picture of it's a little scribble of a man with a huge erection.
A cock and balls.
That's the whole film.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't a clue, it was a hard one, that's it.
Yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But the great thing is, it's like, because the big sleep is confusing.
Yeah.
And it's, but they take...
No one understands the Maltese Falcon. I've watched it. I just don't know what happened. The number of films that I really like, that I watch them again and go, oh, that's what the plot was. And the plot isn't what you remember. All these things about how plot is the driving thing for
no,
Hollywood
what's
drama.
Important is that the character is driven.
Yeah.
And exactly, the more you're lost in that plot, the more you focus actually on those characters and the more you realise that that's what it's about.
Yeah.
It allows the themes to sing, I think.
Yeah.
Do you find that whenever I look a film up on Wikipedia that I really like and I start reading the plot, because it always goes plot, and you read it and you go, I don't remember this film at all. And weirdly, when you boil a film down to its plot, it doesn't feel anywhere near the same as the experience of watching the film, because you're watching theme and character and texture and mood. And I like a good plot, but my God, when you reduce a film down to a description of the action, it feels nothing like the film. And this is a lovely film about how the plot, which is good, it's a solid, good plot with some false leads and some switcheroos and things. And at the end of it, it turned out to be bullshit, because that's not how the world works.
Yeah.
There isn't a big conspiracy out there. It isn't as complicated as that. Sometimes people just are wandering about, meandering and bumping into each other. It's quite a revolutionary thing to say in Hollywood.
That wasn't her toe, dude.
Whose toe was it, Walter?
The fuck should I know?
Where the fuck are they going to get...
You want a toe? I can get you a toe. Believe me. There are ways, dude. You don't want to know about it, believe me.
Yeah, but Walter...
Hell, I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish.
What I love as well is that they don't just sort of take noir and go, that's our playground we want to have fun with. Because it opens, for example, like a Western.
Mm.
And you've got the tumbleweed and this really lovely, rich voice saying, you know, introducing something that sounds really important, and then gradually getting lost. So even the voiceover ends with him going, I lost my train of thought.
Yes. Right, it's a real statement sort of intent, though,
exactly.
Isn't it?
It kind of goes, is this a Western? No, it's not a Western. It's not even going to be really a noir. I think what's really nice about it is that they, of course, it's full of noir homage and reference, but not in a kind of pastiche way. He isn't a private dick. It's not sort of black and white cinematography.
It's not Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. It's not a comedy take on noir.
Yeah, it just uses what it wants to from the films that they want. Well, actually,
they don't even borrow the look. I mean, Roger Deakins, the cinematography of this is
cinematography
just
is
beautiful,
extraordinary.
But it's not. I mean, it's very, very high contrast, and it's very, very, it pops. But it's not. It doesn't use all the lenses and the smoke and or even the monochrome textures of a noir film.
Yeah, it wears its brilliance lightly again, because the temptation for someone who wants to show you how clever they are is to have that conversation with Deakins and say, no, we want this to look like that scene in The Big Sleep, and we want this to look like.
Yeah.
And they're too classy for that. They go, no, it's enough. That's all there in the script. That's enough. We want this just to look like an LA movie.
Yeah, and also look like a Coens movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a love-hate relationship with the Coens. There's some of their films I adore and some of them I'm not bothered with. Mm-hmm. The thing that fascinates me with this is it's the one that gets quoted a lot now as sort of one of their best. People really love it. And it's gone from being sort of an unloved runt to being one that people just quite say, yeah, this goes in the 10 you've got to keep or whatever. What I find with the Coens is that when they're doing straight drama, when they're doing No Country for Old Men or Fargo, I think lots of people do that really well. If you want to watch a really good, tightly written, characterful thriller, you can watch the Coens, or you can watch loads of other people who also will do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anyone does comedy like them. I think their comedies are thoroughly unique. No one else could make this film, and no one else would make a film like this. And if you sort of go, what are you leaving behind? There are other good, there's a guy behind you pursuing you across the desert movies, as well as No Country for Old Men. But there's not another one of these. I love their comic voice. I thought everyone was really rude about Burn After Reading, which is another shambolic meandering.
I loved it.
And I thought, after I watched No Country, I thought, that's pretty good. And I watched Burn After Reading and went, oh God, no one else could have made that. That voice, that comic voice is thoroughly unique.
I often get tired of gaggy comedies. And I think it's partly just jealousy, because it's a skill I can't do. But I also think comedy is often at risk of being the guy at the party who you get cornered by, who thinks they're really funny.
Trying too hard.
Yeah. And I love stuff that this is a great example of. It doesn't try too hard. It doesn't even really present itself fully as a comedy. It's not only concerned with making you laugh.
Yes.
And it's never making you laugh. It's very rarely making you laugh with gags. The reason I revised from never to very rarely is because there's that brilliant visual thing with the baton that he nails into the floor. Which is absolutely...
Nails
this thing into the floor in order to wedge a chair under the handle, so that, because people keep showing up in his flat, and then he just gets the last nail in, and then that's what's brilliant in the shot. You can see how many nails there are and at all kinds of angles. He's clearly been doing this for ages, and then he gets the last one in, and then the door just opens outwards the other way and they walk in. But then later on, he comes home and trips over the thing on the floor. So, that's a perfect rule of three.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So there's moments where it does play very overtly comic. But I think a lot of the time, it's the character and the detail that's funny. And I love that. I mean, that's something that I love to do in things that I write as well. Something I'm really fond of is when you're made to laugh just simply through the voice of a character. Yeah. Or, for example, inarticulate character. That's something I love is characters who cannot articulate themselves very well.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, the dude, for example, when Jesus brags to them about the bowling.
My point is...
Are you ready to be fucked, man? I see you roll your way into the semis. Dios mio, man. Liam and me, we're gonna fuck you up.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
That's his comeback. It's so brilliant how inarticulate they are. There are so many laughs that you get through that.
Yeah,
that's the opposite of, say, of the other thing America does really, really well is those zingy Friends cheer style where you have a load of rich characters and each one of them pings a zinger at each other. And what's lovely about this is that it's got a sitcom cast of big characters, but they don't do any zingers.
No,
I mean, Walter's got quite a good turn of phrase and things.
I could get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon.
I can get you a toe.
And you're being very undued. Yeah. It's one of my favourite lines.
Oh, God, the lovely bit where Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, who's the valet to the Big Lebowski, the millionaire, and he starts joining Jeff Bridges' character in calling him the dude. And there's a lovely moment where suddenly you go, and it's almost the only character who's been listening to another character. Like, suddenly you go, oh, hang on, he's in Jeff Bridges' film. Because all the films are running in parallel and never touching. And there's something hilarious about the way that character, who is someone who's attentive and listens because it's his job, suddenly goes, oh, he's now talking to Jeff Bridges as if he's his butler. And it's this little touch. Yeah. Not a joke, but it's just funny.
Yeah, I think the thing you say about people being in different films, that there's a great scene, that they call it the big room scene, where you've got the sort of this important man staring into the fireplace and reflecting on.
It's a nod to Amadeus, isn't it? Because it was that Salieri sitting in his wheelchair by the fire, and they've got the Mozart Requiem playing in the background.
I think the Coen brothers say we've put a big room scene in almost every film we've done. And what's lovely in the Lebowski version is that the dude is not... he can't play along with that genre. Yeah. He can't play along with the portentous atmosphere that Lebowski is trying to create as he gazes into the fire and says, what is a man?
Yeah.
And they wanted to get Brando for that, by the way. They used to read the lines to each other in Brando's voice.
Have you seen their wish list for the Big Lebowski before they got David Huddleston? Included Robert Duvall, Anthony Hopkins, Gene Hackman, Jack Nicholson, Rod Steiger, Larry Hagman, Norman Mailer, Jerry Falwell, Lloyd Bridges, Gore Vidal, Jason Robards, James Coburn, Jackie Cooper, George C. Scott, Paul Dooley, Michael Caine, and General Norman Schwarzkopf.
Because it's got that thing where it's set in 1991, and it's got a lovely... Because it's their playfulness with the way of what you're expecting, the expectations. Is it set in 1991? They're all talking about the stranger at the beginning. Says this is about the time we had the war with the Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a political film that have some political points. And it sort of doesn't.
No, and that's another thing that doesn't go anywhere.
I'm watching out for that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are Lebowski obsessives who will be deeply disappointed by this podcast.
I think it's actually code for something.
Yeah, I genuinely think, it's especially kind of learning a little bit more about how they wrote it, that I don't think they're making some zen kind of comment here, really. I think they're putting together, again, the music thing. I think they're putting together something that they think is rhythmically, tonally interesting.
Yeah.
They're putting contrasts together and going, should we open it like a Western? And then, that's watchable.
What condition my condition was in.
Apparently, it began, there was a guy that they knew, I think, who they refer to as Uncle Pete or Uncle Paul, who was a Vietnam vet, who they were in this guy's house or apartment, and he, for want of something else to say, one of them complimented the rug, and he kept using the phrase, it really ties the room together. And they thought, oh, that's really, that's funny. That is a sentence that gets repeated. That's funny. Then they knew this guy, Jeff the Dude Dowd, who called himself the Pope of Dope. but literally the dude, you know, and they thought those two together, that would be fun. And then they heard this story about a stolen car being recovered and they found a piece of homework in it.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So
right.
That's what, is they collaged bits of other people's stories.
So they just went, two men that we know, we're just going to have them. And the thing, that true story we got told about the homework in the car, and that feels like, okay, there's a crime. There's a case they've got to solve. They've got to find the kid who left the homework so they can find out who stole the car. And that's what it grew from. And then they just began.
What's refreshing about it is it's not been assembled via the rules of storytelling. And maybe you're sort of saying that you like things that aren't gag. You get weary of gag-heavy films, whereas this is a tonal and a mood thing, and it's enjoyable for character and things. You can re-watch something which has got a non-linear musical assemblage of pieces probably more than you can watch something that tightly goes from A to B to C.
I think so.
Because you don't get weary of it.
No, and you notice new things, and exactly
it's like a painting or a piece of art. You can see new things in it because it's not just doing one thing. It is elusive. I wrote this down because I thought it was so beautiful. Umberto Eco was talking about how to make a cult movie, and he said a cult movie must be ramshackle, rickety, unhinged in itself. Only an unhinged movie survives as a disconnected series of images, of peaks, of visual icebergs. It should display not one central idea, but many, and it should not reveal a coherent philosophy of composition. It must live on, and because of, its glorious ricketiness. Mm. I thought, he was writing about Casablanca.
Well, we can all do that, mate.
And you go, but it feels like you're going...
Ricketiness, yeah.
But it feels like you're sort of saying, oh, aim low, but oddly, loads of great movies are made of...
Yeah, I mean, that to me doesn't sound like aiming low. That sounds like something absolutely to aspire
to. That's a bloody good point, yeah.
I think that's hard. That's really hard to do.
You've got to have faith in your ability to be able to keep the audience's interest without something as basic as a plot.
Yes.
And at the same time as that, you look at this movie and you go, but it's got a great plot.
Yeah, but we're as interested, if not more, in the stuff that happens outside of that plot. I think
you're allowed to be. Sort of, you're permitted
it's
to.
It's something that one of the sort of common things of themes of bad writing for me. The thing that I notice the most, sort of, as an actor reading scripts I've been sent, and also just as someone watching things and thinking, why don't I like this? Is when dialogue is dealing with plot.
Yeah.
You go. It's as if silent film was never a thing. We know that we can tell the stories without anyone talking about them. We know that that's possible, and yet, for the most part, dialogue is people saying, "What just happened? Mm. Oh, well, then I guess we got to solve that problem. What should we do next? Here's what we'll do next. Cut to that scene. Here's what we're doing now that we said we were going to do in the last scene." And it's just. I've done shows, and as an actor, they're just an absolute... And you just go... But if you find ways to tell your story... And by the way, you can watch almost anything on mute and follow the story. So the obsession, you know, of notes of like, is this clear? Are people going to understand? Yes, they are. They do.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of it gets told visually through your cuts and through the action that happens.
I wondered if that was because people are looking at their phones.
Well, these days, I suppose it's a different matter. But my point is that if you can tell your story visually and deftly, then you free up the dialogue. Yeah. Then the dialogue is a playground for other stuff, for other textures.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, for example, what do people remember about Pulp Fiction? They remember them talking about burgers.
Yeah.
And the fact they put the mayonnaise on, you know.
It's perfect. That was the most amazing thing where for a while they would get in Tarantino onto other action movies to add dialogue that wasn't about the action. So they would talk about old comics in a submarine picture. And for a while, before you noticed that was his trick, it blew your mind that the characters were talking about something else while driving to an assassination.
Yeah, well, the first thing you saw of Tarantino was the guys all sitting around discussing whether or not you should tip the waitress in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that scene, you didn't give a shit about their opinions about tips, but you went, God, they're hard, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, I know who they are, but none of them has told me who they are.
Mm. Yes, you reveal character through dialogue and the plot just runs along underneath it.
And Lebowski's full of these, you know, it cuts to them bowling, the dude explains where he's at with the plot, and very, very quickly it's about the Pomeranian which isn't a Pomeranian either. It's about the fact that Walter's brought his ex-wife's dog, and you know, they're talking about that.
There's so much furniture hanging off this story, isn't there? So many bits and pieces. It's so well decorated. It's even down to things like going round to visit the kid who's stolen the car and seeing that his dad is a famous author who's in an iron lung on the other side of the room, can't talk, or arriving at the artist's place and her going over his head naked in a harness throwing paint. It's full of these wonderful,
everyone's lives are running alongside, and the film passes through hundreds of other lives, which is what happens in real life. You go around someone's house, they have a story of their own going on in the background that is told through the detritus that's on the picture on the piano or whatever. The things you can see, you go, oh, my story isn't the only story in this, is how we exist.
I mean, that's a writing cliche, I guess, too, is, and I don't know who said it first, no minor characters. No one is a minor character in their own life. They're all the centre of their own story. And if you're smart and creative, then you can make sure that even if you need someone, if you need a butler, you can still give them an inner life and make them work on more than one functional level. It's hard to be bothered to do that. It's easy to know that that's a rule, but it's hard to do it.
It's a discipline, but I think you must know this as an actor, and we find it as writers, is you do the thing and you get the plot working, you get the characters working, and there are jokes in it and it's good. Mm-hmm. You finish the script and you hand it over to the cast, and suddenly the cast are there and you go, oh shit, we didn't give you anything to do. We didn't give you an inner life. The one character you've just gone, oh, it's just the woman in the delicatessen. And the actor turns up and goes, so who is she? And you go, fuck, I didn't think. Mm. And you are so embarrassed by it that you get bitten by that a few times. And the next time you go, we are better, before we hand this over to a professional person who wants to know, is she high status, low status, where's she from? Well, I should have thought about that, because it would have made the writing better. And you'll have more fun as an actor, and I'll get a better actor for this part. Mm. If the script goes out and there's some inner life for them.
We always say that to each other, writing stuff, you know, that if I got sent this, you know. So that's... It's quite a good window, I think, that you have as a performer when you're writing, that you can look at it from that point of view whenever you choose to, and identify when you've been slightly lazy. But it improves the work. That's the thing, ultimately, that if you can find some sort of colour for every character in every moment. And often, if you throw stuff in that feels like it's just there for colour or texture... In my experience, you can bet that somewhere further down the line, you'll go, oh, we can actually, there's a plot thing we can do there.
Yeah.
We had a thing in The Wrong Man's where the kidnapper shows up at Sam's office and it's, oh my God, he's tracked me down. It's scary. There's this bit we had where Sam is stood at the lift because we just thought it was funny. If you have to stand with this scary man and wait for the lift to come, Sam starts kind of asking what his journey, has he come from far? And that was it. It was just a sort of tag on the end of a scene. Then we had a thing where later on, someone gets murdered in front of them. Sam is covered in the dead person's blood. They've got to get rid of these clothes. And we had to have a reason why Sam couldn't go home. We knew they couldn't go to the office because they'd been seen at the office. So that's where the kidnappers could go to find them. And we knew they couldn't go to Phil's for another reason. Why can they not go to Sam's? And we go, oh, the bit where he waffles on about the journey, Sam can accidentally give him his address.
Oh, brilliant.
So you've got that texture, and it's there for a funny reason. It's not there for a plot reason, and no one will notice it's there for a plot reason because it wasn't.
Because it's a joke.
But you just feed that in. So you then have this moment in the car where he's going, I need to change my clothes, and Phil goes, well, we'll go home and get some more. And he's like, ah. Oh. I told him my address. Your address? Why would you give it? You know. But I think that's the kind of aim that you're going for. It's like you don't want plot and texture to be kind of different things.
But also it's a good example of how the harder you work something, the more it starts to become real or feel real. And actually that work pays off not only in one way, but in unexpected ways. You're making your job easier all the time, the more work you do.
Even down to, you know, the landlord who's doing a dance recital.
Oh, I love that.
And then that's just a good setting for exactly what we just talked about. There's a bit of plot that needs to be covered.
So you do it at the landlord's dance recital.
I think that's the bit where they've found the homework, I think.
Yeah. One of the biggest plot elements in the film.
And Walter's found out where this kid lives and says, you know, that's where we'll go. But while that's happening, we may as well have some really bad modern dance thing. Latex. Like amateur.
In spandex, whatever.
Extraordinary setting. It makes me think of Sam and Jesse used to say about Peep Show that they would just try to think of more interesting places to go than the pub for the characters, you know, because you're used to seeing sitcoms about buddies who you spend all the time in their flat or at the pub.
It just also, I think the problem is when you're trying to get the thing to sit down and behave and trying to get plot to go from A to B, it feels like a lot of fucking work.
Mm.
And the answer is, yes, it is. It's a lot of fucking work.
It should be a lot of work.
But all creative things are just a series of decisions. Yeah. And each decision leads to a series of other decisions. And when you watch when you watch something complete and enjoyable, what you're watching is thousands and thousands of good decisions.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, right? When I sat down to watch this again, and I think it's probably about the 12th time I've watched it now, because it's so rewatchable, because it's a meal you can have again and again. And I was watching the opening of it with a slightly more critical eye and going, okay, what they're doing, how they're doing it. And you're getting that narration and the tumbleweed and the music, and then you're getting the dude who is wandering around Ralph's late at night and just being very picky about which carton of half and half he gets. And
this milk's
important to him, isn't it, for some reason? And you realise why pretty later on, because every drink he has is a white Russian or a Caucasian. But it was odd because I got so invested in the guy, and I was going, yeah, it's great. He's wearing Bermuda shorts. He doesn't care. He's wearing a sort of dressing gown thing, which we were talking about beforehand, and going, people in dressing gowns are vulnerable. They're not ready for the day yet, are they?
It's,
you know?
Arthur Dent. It's the kid in Time Bandits, and it's the dude, which weirdly, all those have turned up as things for Rule of Three. People love a protagonist in a dressing gown.
Yeah, that's a good tip for writers out there.
I think the Harry Nilsson-Smilson movie is the next thing that's going to get made.
But the thing is that I watched the clock. It was 23 minutes into the film when I went, oh, it's Jeff Bridges, isn't it? I hadn't noticed Jeff Bridges underneath all that dude.
The dude.
Because he's so the dude from the minute he slouches around that supermarket aisle.
I thought what you were going to say is that aside from this wonderful sort of textural thing about that opening and what it's telling you about the character, they're secretly just setting up a perfect visual gag, which is that the more time he spends picking that milk, sniffing to make sure it's fine, and so on, the more you are subconsciously setting up to laugh when the first thing that happens when he walks into his apartment is he gets rammed through the house, his face down into the toilet, and the milk smashes on the side of the toilet and goes everywhere. You go, we've just witnessed a whole minute of him buying this milk and it's gone.
And it has to be spilt.
Yeah.
Because that's what happened to his life. Someone has rammed through it in a truck.
And that's like, also a brilliant bit of dialogue in there, where he's going, where's the money, Lebowski?
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the fucking money, shithead?
Oh, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
For the most part, a lot of the comedy with him comes from the fact he's inarticulate, he's thinking on his feet, he's not really well equipped to sort of deal with situations unfolding in front of him. But there's a couple of times where he wisecracked.
There's quite a few in the first scene, aren't there? Because he says, like, you know, when the guy pulls out the bowling ball.
Does this place look like I'm fucking married? The toilet seat's up, man!
What the fuck is this?
Obviously, you're not a golfer.
And also at the end of it, when he walks away, the dude says, well, at least I'm housebroken.
Yeah.
The easy thing would be to make him an ineffectual stoner. But actually, the thing about him is he's clever and he's witty.
Yeah.
And he's happy in his own skin. And he's got a really good moral compass. He's a good guy. He wants to help out. He gets caught up in this accidentally because he wants to make things right. And that makes him a hero. And I think that's why people go to Big Lebowski conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a nice person to aspire to. That's quite a nice worldview.
I wonder what goes on at a Big Lebowski convention.
Dressing up.
And drinking lots of white Russians. Yeah.
But actually, no, it's bowling, apparently. There's lots of bowling.
Oh, that makes sense.
Apparently, bowling and dressing gowns.
The directorial note that they gave him is that he used to wander on set for each scene and entering a new scene and go over to Joel Cohen and say, do you think the dude burned one up on the way over?
And they said,
he'd just go into a corner and rub his eyes for about 10 minutes.
But it gives him this brilliant sort of contrasting energy to what you expect in those kind of scenes. So I can't remember what... There's a piece of plot information that I think Walter poses the theory that maybe she kidnapped herself or something.
Yeah.
I think it's in that moment. And the line is, that's interesting, that's fucking interesting. In any other film, that would be quite front foot. It would be a moment of energy. Oh, new idea. That's fucking interesting. And there'd be that sense of, where's this going to take us? The dude is doing his warm-ups for bowling, and he's like, his arms are out and his head is back looking at the ceiling. And so instead of a front-footed energy, it's, that's fucking interesting. And it's complete. It's just, I just love those contrasts to what.
But again, that's making a choice. That's saying,
exactly,
how
I'm not going to do that thing. I'm going to do this thing.
And that's the actor making a choice. That's the director making a choice. That's the screenwriter making a choice. And every one of these things, nothing's missing. Well, the weird thing about this film is that despite it not having what appears to be a structure or a plot, because the plot doesn't have to not matter and things, it has got all those beats in. They've just decided to play them slightly unexpectedly or at a weird angle. And so you watch it, and the reason I think it's satisfying, at the end of it, you know they haven't made this film wrong because they're incompetent. They've made this film right because they're so skilled at this, they can still keep you interested. And I've watched Coen Brothers films where they've made all these decisions. At the end of it, I haven't given a shit about any of the characters because they've tried different angles. And they occasionally do it where they've made it so loose and they've made so many maverick decisions that it doesn't quite stick. And I think, weirdly, this is about as out there as they go and still hold your attention and still have the shape and the satisfaction of a full meal rather than it being thin gruel because they've turned too many of the dials down low.
I think maybe it's just, there's a simplicity to it. For all the complication and all the richness, it's totally linear. Everything is just a response to what happened last.
Yes.
You know,
it follows all the rules.
So however complicated it gets, you don't have to hold anything more in your head.
You could be quite stoned and watch it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the secret.
I must have watched it stoned at some point. You must have watched it stoned at some point.
Yeah, I think several of those DVD viewings would have been. There was a base level in my bloodstream at that time of my life.
Yeah.
That made this the perfect film.
That could not have been, yeah.
Yeah, it's a film that can be watched passively or actively.
Yeah.
You can enjoy it in any.
How was your meeting, Mr. Lebowski?
Okay. The old man told me to take any rug in the house.
The lovely thing about the White Russians as well is it's the most complicated drink, signature drink, to insist everyone's got the ingredients for. Yeah, everywhere he goes.
Everywhere he goes in Los Angeles and Pasadena, he can get, someone's got Kahlua. Everywhere he goes. Kahlua, sorry. Yeah. Everyone's got it, apparently.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know if that's true of California.
And there's something about the fact that milk is in it.
Yeah.
aside from the fact that it's funny that he answers the door with a little bit of milk in his moustache. I mean, that's a great thing in the mall at the beginning is that you see him sniff the milk. You don't see him drink any, but when he stands in front of the checkout girl, there's a little bit of milk in his moustache. It's just such, again, that's a decision. You've made a great little decision. The audience might not notice it. That's fine, because if they do, they're rewarded for the fact that they're paying attention and they will laugh at the detail.
While he's writing a cheque for 67 cents, meaning that he can't even afford this milk.
And watching that little speech, the aggression will not stand. I mean, that's another lovely detail, is that he quotes other people throughout the film, which again, this sort of
line in the sand
that he's not particularly articulate, is that he just picks up other people's phrases because he hasn't got his own. So like trophy wife in the parlance of our time, which is borrowed from Maud.
It makes him a passive hero, which is a really attractive thing. It's really enjoyable watching someone float through a film that is, again, Hollywood likes a propulsive, active hero. It's what you're supposed to have. And they've made the decision to say, well, what would it be like? It's like someone having, you say it's like music, it's like someone having a mixing desk and saying, well, what's it like if we drop the bass out? What's it like if we replace the lead instrument with a bass instrument? And the lead instrument should be this action, propulsion, melodic instrument. Well, what if it's just a keyboard? What if it's just like some pads? And they've decided to say, what happens if we swap this up? And they're tinkering with the faders on Hollywood storytelling. And again, what that comes down to is that this is just about decisions. And the reason this is a delightful film is that either you like those decisions and you find joy in watching them again and again and being delighted by the surprise of them, or you don't like the decisions. And that first set of reviews that were really excoriating about it were people who said they should have made different decisions because they did in Fargo. Mm-hmm. if you've mastered all the techniques, you can start dicking about. But the one thing you've got to do is make solid decisions that this is what you're going to do, and do it with absolute attention.
And it's that thing that, I mean, I'm enormously jealous of writers who just start, carry on, finish, with no planning. You know, they do exist. These mythical
creatures. If you read Stephen King's On Writing, which is a guide on how, if you're Stephen King, you can just do that and start and then finish. At the end of it, well, that was no use of fucking... it's like stage it's not one, very helpful. Be me.
It's like saying be... I mean, in some ways it's not helpful, but George Saunders wrote a brilliant piece on how he writes, where he said, I have a needle on my forehead. I write a sentence, and if the needle goes to the line that says good... I write the next sentence. If it goes to the line that says not so good, I tinker with this one until the needle goes good, and then I move on to the next one. I think the thing with Lebowski, right, is that every scene, there's nothing that's there just because it has to be because of the structure. Each scene in and of itself is a great scene. When he goes to Lebowski's house, you have a great scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman as Brandt, as they look through all the things on the wall.
Oh, God, also...
It's entertaining in and of itself, each moment of it.
There's a job that isn't in screenwriting but is in animation, which is story. You see them credited in all the Pixar movies. They also... Disney used to have it, story people. And you can see it when you see... I went to see the second Incredibles movie, and it plays like a lot of shorts. They're all scenes. And the reason those Pixars are terrific is they are made up of loads of scenes that are like short cartoons, that are proper little Warner Brothers cartoons. There's a scene where a babysitter is attacked. That's your scene or whatever. Mm-hmm. And each one has to be entertaining on its own. And they do their story, they build their stories that way by making it out of a string of scenes that are all entertaining in their own right. Yeah. And what you end up with there is films, especially, you look at those Pixars, you watch them, if you've got kids, you've seen them dozens of times, and you are not bored with the good ones because they have been made out of a series of scenes. Yeah. Like Lebowski is, it's not just the first time you watch it, you enjoy the narrative unfolding. The second time you watch it, you go, oh, this next scene's coming up.
Yeah.
They are exactly what Umberto Eco said. They are peak after peak after peak after peak. Yeah.
Jeremy Dyson script edited the first series of The Wrong Mans and said a brilliant thing at one point, which again, I don't know if... it came from him or he'd got it from somewhere, that going through a script and looking at the stuff that wasn't working or that was least interesting, and kind of making a list of the bits that were least interesting, and literally just going, how do I turn all of these into my favourite bits?
Yeah.
And scenes like the Brandt thing, when you've got scenes that have to be there for the story, we have to get from this point to this point, because otherwise we can't have the thing that we all love that we came up with, where Walter beats up the car or whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are scenes that do exist because you need to join from A to B. But there is always, if you look at it, the potential to turn that scene into your favourite scene somehow. And a scene like that, I think, Brandt could just say, wait here, and Lebowski could come in. But they find this great material just in, you know, how do we establish that the real Lebowski is this kind of serious businessman, someone who is to be taken seriously and with authority? Well, we could have a bunch of stuff on the wall. Okay, that's a bit of set dressing. That will tell you that. But what if we have a butler who's immensely proud that he works for this man, and the dude is touching the... I mean, there's such a lovely detail. The dude just touching these bits on the wall, and you can just see Seymour Hoffman just sort of...
Don't touch it.
Please don't do that. And he's trying to be polite because he's the butler, right? Yeah, yeah. So he can't be, you know, but he's...
Hey, you should, when you go back and watch it again, by the way, watch Philip Seymour Hoffman when his character laughs, because his nostrils laugh at the same time as his mouth.
Just a moment before his nostrils go, right? It's when she says, I'll suck your dick for $1,000. And he just sort of, it starts, you're right, in his nose, and then the rest of him joins in. Oh, we're all so fond of her.
Yeah. fun fact, Tara Reid had a toe double for that film.
Did she?
Those aren't her toes. Blimey. Isn't that exciting?
Gosh.
It's just such a lovely thing to talk about something which is such a good example of how you can break all the rules and yet follow all the rules. Because usually when you're given an example of great Hollywood filmmaking, you're constantly told, you must follow all these rules. And this just says, yeah, know the rules, but you can probably just dick around with them all.
Mm.
And at the end of it, if you've worked hard enough and thought hard enough, it'll be so entertaining that it won't matter that you didn't actually follow.
I mean, it's such a good example of so many things.
We haven't even talked about the scattering of the ashes, which is one of, I think, the funniest images in cinema. You sort of can't believe they'd been the first to do it. It's one of those images that classic, it feels like it should have already existed.
And people tell you that's happened to them, and still I've not seen it in a film. I've heard people say, oh yeah, we scattered it somewhere and it blew all over us.
And it's executed so perfectly that he delivers a eulogy to his meek friend begins to go off on Vietnam and the other people who died.
In accordance with what we think your last wishes might have been or something, isn't it?
Because he never listens to it.
He shakes all of the ashes out, and it takes a while, and they just hold that one shot. It's so perfect. The ashes actually fill the frame of the camera for a while before they clear, and you see the dude is stood there, and it's eight, and the dude just stays still for ages with Walter going, oh, I'm sorry, beginning to sort of pat him down before the dude just finally explodes. But it ends with a hug. It ends with the sort of, you know, the dude's just like, why is everything fucking about nice and with... You know, he finally kind of explodes, and then you just have this moment of, as you say, it's a great depiction of male, of sort of impotent male rage.
And then it ends with this,
it's, you know, the dude is who he needs.
But again, that's the final message you're left with the film, because it's a meandering, it's supposed to be inconsequential, but that's the joke it's meant to be. But the final message is that you've seen them be lovely to Donnie suddenly and be sentimental about him and fuck it up and do it badly, and then you've seen them be friends. And the final thing you get, as you do with Nell, is you go, actually, these people needed each other. So at the end of the film, who cares about the rug? Who cares about the kidnap? All you care about is that you've had a nice time, you've spent some time with these people, and you want to do it again, which is the key to a cult film, because you want to go back and spend more time with these people because you've enjoyed their company.
Yeah.
And look, they're lovely, even though on paper they're both awful. Don't make them likable, make them so you want to spend time with them.
Yeah, make them
That's
flawed.
That's the key. What object lesson in writing a good comedy. Brilliant. Thank you for bringing Big Lebowski, what a pleasure.
Total pleasure.
Thank you, Matt Bainton.